We are in 2 Samuel chapter 14.
Now Joab the son of Zeruiah knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. And Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, "Pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. Go to the king and speak thus to him." So Joab put the words in her mouth. When the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and paid homage and said, "Save me, O king." And the king said to her, "What is your trouble?" She answered, "Alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead. And your servant had two sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to separate them, and one struck the other and killed him. And now the whole clan has risen against your servant, and they say, 'Give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed.' And so they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal that is left, and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth." Then the king said to the woman, "Go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you." And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, "On me be the guilt, my lord the king, and on my father's house. Let the king and his throne be guiltless." The king said, "If anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall never touch you again." Then she said, "Please let the king invoke the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more, and my son be not destroyed." He said, "As the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground." Then the woman said, "Please let your servant speak a word to my lord the king." He said, "Speak." And the woman said, "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, the king convicts himself, inasmuch as the king does not bring his banished one home again. We must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life, and he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. Now I have come to say this to my lord, the king, because the people have made me afraid, and your servant thought, 'I will speak to the king, and maybe that the king will perform the request of his servant. The king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would destroy me, and my son together from the heritage of God.' And your servant thought, 'The word of my lord the king will set me at rest. For my lord the king is like an angel of God to discern good and evil. The Lord your God be with you.' Then the king answered the woman, 'Do not hide from me anything I ask you.' And the woman said, 'Let my lord the king speak.' The king said, 'Is the hand of Joab with you in all of this?' The woman answered and said, 'As surely as you live, my lord the king, one cannot turn to the right hand or to the left from anything that my lord the king has said. It was your servant Joab who commanded me. It was he who put all these words in the mouth of your servant. In order to change the course of things, your servant Joab did this. But my lord his wisdom, like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all things that are on the earth.' Then the king said to Joab, 'Behold now, I grant this. Go bring back the young man Absalom.' And Joab fell on his face to the ground and paid homage and blessed the king. And Joab said, 'Today your servant knows that I found favor in your sight, my lord the king, and that the king has granted the request of his servant.' So Joab aroused and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, 'Let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence.' So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence. Now in all Israel there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it, when it was heavy on him, he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head 200 shekels by the king's weight. There were born to Absalom 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. So Absalom lived 2 years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but Joab would not come to him. And he sent a second time, but Joab would not come. Then he said to his servants, 'See, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire.' So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose and went to Absalom at his house and said to him, 'Why have your servants set my field on fire?' Absalom answered Joab, "Behold, I sent word to you, come here, that I may send you to the king, to ask why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be here, be there still. Now therefore, let me go into the presence of the king, and if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death." Then Joab went to the king and told him, and he summoned Absalom. So he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom.
Thank you. That was 2 Samuel chapter 14. Before I go our little spiel, as I usually do, are there any questions or comments regarding this particular chapter? As we had background for the previous chapters, of course, these chapters build upon one another. We had chapter 13, which is, of course, the death of Amnon by Absalom's hand, and of course, he had to flee. He fled in Geshur for 2 years, three years there, before he was brought back. Now, we had discussed quite great detail, which I'm going to finish today, regarding the striking similarities between the story of Amnon and Tamar with David and Bathsheba with Adam and Eve. I'll show the chart again because I referenced it one more time today. As far as how many there were, as far as duplicates, which implied a equivalency amongst these three events. And in fact, they are equivalent as far as the Bible is concerned. Yes, there are, of course, detailed differences. We're not interested in detailed differences. We're interested in all the numerous duplicates of one another. Well, chapter 14 here finishes that off. Because chapter 15 starts something brand new. Brand new because it actually maps out Messiah's life in chapter 15 on through 21. Messiah recorded in the Gospels. We'll be discussing that later. But chapter 14 does something rather unique. It is a second witness used to verify that Adam and Eve match David and Bathsheba, who match Amnon and Tamar. It is an additional one that's independent of the thematic ties. I'll discuss that shortly. But are there any comments regarding what you read in chapter 14? Seems like a pretty simple chapter. Yes, Piran.
Tamar and a sister named Tamar.
You notice there's a unique contradiction. you notice that it says in verse, what verse was it? I forgot. Absalom's children, verse 27. Three sons and a daughter, right? That's what it claims. Yeah, now we already discussed this, that Absalom had a younger sister named Tamar, who of course was violated by Amnon, who, after that violation, Absalom took her in as his own daughter. So did he have a biological daughter named Tamar and a sister named Tamar, both of which are now his daughters? Probably not. Now, we also bring the next question up, those of you who noticed this. It says he had three sons. Well, that's odd, though we have not read chapter 18. It points out Amnon had no children. No biological children, that is. Absalom, sorry, Absalom, no biological children. So if Absalom has no biological children in chapter 18, yet he has three sons and a daughter here in chapter 14, who are they? Most likely his brothers. You see, contrary to our common way of life, we have one man with one wife produces one family. Not one man with many wives producing many families. Independent of one another. Well, back then, which is actually not too terribly uncommon in certain cultures today, the oldest son becomes head of that family in absence of the father. Well, now, we say, well, David's not absent, he's right here. Well, how attentive is he to his family? He's not. Why is he not? He's divided up between many families. He is the king. So who's responsible for each of these women and their households? The oldest son. You recall the event with Reuben and his, if not his mother's stepmom, I guess you'd call it. He was taking charge of the household of everyone as being the new father. All of his brothers, after having slept with, which one was it? I forgot her name. Bilhah or Rachel's handmaid. After he slept with her, that is, taking acknowledgement, all of my brothers are now my children. That's what it does. Now, of course, what did that bring? Utter disgrace and disdain to him amongst everyone. They obviously didn't like it. Well, in this particular instance, Absalom, of course, didn't do that yet. We'll discuss when he does that later. But he's taking ownership of his family. Hence, he has three younger brothers and one younger sister, who are his sons and daughter. That is one. That is the most common explanation why chapter 18 says he has no children, chapter 14 says he does. One of those two chapters are conflicting. Since they know this is an acceptable event in their culture at the time, they figure this is probably what's going on in chapter 14. So yes, I don't think he had a daughter named Tamar and a younger sister named Tamar. Most likely they're one and the same person. They're both strikingly beautiful women, too. Conveniently named the same, or titled the same. Any other comments or questions in chapter 14? Okay. Before I go into my normal spiel, I have to talk about a little few details here. These are just factual statements which you read that the text actually says. Joab, of course, contrives this scheme. To say, okay, I need to convince David that to look at this objectively. Now, David, as we found out in many times in the past, is a very passionate, somewhat emotional individual. Man after God's own heart. If he's that way, Joab, instead of going to David directly saying, why should you bring your son back? He contrives this whole story, an elaborate plan about this woman, the Tekoahite woman. Why wouldn't he go by himself? Tammy.
Maybe because he knows that David has a soft spot for women?
Ah, good question. Good point. I hadn't thought about that one. That could be. He may have. Maybe that's what Joab was figuring. Well, you know, he's easily bent to a woman's will. Maybe he'll go to this one too. She's obviously a very wise lady. I had figured, maybe I'm wrong, maybe she's absolutely right, that Joab probably had talked to David about this subject matter and David wasn't willing to hear him. That was my figuring, but that she has a really good point. He may have actually just been, well, hey, no, he'll listen to a woman. Maybe both. Because I noted that it didn't take a whole lot for David to figure out that Joab set her up to it. He didn't say, oh, who said, you know, did Joab do this? He probably heard the argument at some point in time in the past from Joab's mouth himself. Did you notice any similarities in chapter 14 to something you read earlier in other chapters? The most obvious similarity. What's the most obvious thing that strikes you in chapter 14 that you've just read this recently? What similarity are you referring to, Ellie? When Nathan goes, right? That's the most common thing everybody thinks about. Because, yeah, exactly. So in chapter 12, we know that Nathan goes to David regarding his affair with Bathsheba. He contrives this story. And then David, of course, sees the story, objectively decides the proper course of action is to match what the Torah states. You pay fourfold for what you've done. He's a little upset with the individual in the story. Now, Nathan's story, you know, to match David and Bathsheba and Uriah really, really well, didn't it? It's almost like God created that story, didn't he? Joab's story, how well does Joab's story match Amnon and Absalom? Not so well. Did God create that story? Did he give that to Joab? Probably not. Did God use that story? Yeah, you better believe he used it. He knows Joab's heart as well as he knows mine or David's. So this story that's contrived, it doesn't fit super well. There are some holes. There aren't just two sons. Not like there is no widow. There is no, oh, banish my father's house. None of that story actually would happen with Absalom and Tamar and Amnon. But the story is still, either way, it's there. But it brings up the other story, the other image, the image of Nathan, which is what it's supposed to do. There's a couple of the details here before I go into why it does that. We're going to go to, let's see here. I'm going to ask you a question. When you're reading the story and you're reading the words she was saying and her responses and David's going back and forth, did it strike you as what an odd conversation? Of what's being said? And then it's like, okay, let's say it again. Let's repeat this. They're like, they're disagreeing but agreeing, and it kind of doesn't mix well, right? Does it? Or did anybody else catch that? Because to me, when I read the story, when she was relaying it, and the king asked, well, nothing happened to your son. She says, but my family would like that. Oh, don't worry, I'll take care of your family. But he finally says, you're fine. Nothing's going to happen to your son. Relax. And she makes him, well, you swear to me that's the case, on God's name. Fine, so he swears to her on God's name. Why is she going to such extremes in this conversation to be such an odd conversation? Any thoughts? And by the way, after, then she repeats the entire thing by relaying it backwards to him as to why she did it. As if he couldn't figure that out. Any thoughts? Why would she do this? Why is the story written in this fashion? It's just happenstance? Well, it just happened to me, it's a bad translation, is that the deal? Yeah, go ahead, Ellie.
She may have wanted to be able to tell Joab, I went the extra mile in trying to talk to the king. And he said, well, now did you tell him? I told him. How many times? I told him over and over. Over and over, and that's what he said. Because she's going to be responsible to Joab for how well she did.
Well, he actually gave the story to her, didn't he?
Yeah.
He told her, you must say this, and you must say this, and you must say this, and you must say this. He relays all the details to her to match it out. She happens to be a very good actress and very wise. She's able to do it. So this odd conversation of repetition and verifying and guaranteeing that David would not back up on his word, is that also part of Joab's scheme? Most likely. Joab wanted her to say, no, I want to tell you, imagine you being Joab, talking to this woman. Okay, you know, go with this story about, you know, two sons, you got a husband who's dead, both, you wipe out the family's line, make sure he guarantees your son's safety, swears in God's name it won't happen, and if anybody says otherwise, he's going to come against them. Make sure he says those 3 points. Most likely that's what he had her do. Because David's not going to sit there and say, well, I was wrong, once the story is revealed to him. That's a cursory explanation. It kind of makes sense. Maybe that's what he was doing. Well, knowing the Bible, not that I know it that well, but I'm working on it, as most of us are, God doesn't work quite that, how do we use the word, messy, without a reason. Redundant, without a reason. We repetition for a purpose. It's not just for the fun of it. It's not because, oh, we just feel like writing extra words because I'm just really good penmanship. That's not the case. God doesn't do that kind of work. He does it for purposes. It gains him something out of it. This story is no different than most of the stories written in 2 Samuel. They're thematic ties to more stories. Designed to catch your attention. The confusing way this story is written out is to draw your attention to a particular verse. We'll get to that verse in a minute. So we have this really bizarre conversation. And she then, after explaining to David what happened, she goes back and says, this is what I was thinking when I did it. That would go through the process. Well, he certainly would save my family, thus he would produce a good ruling, thus he'd be objective. David is not a fool. Once she revealed the story to him, that why are you doing this to Absalom and not my son, that she needs to go through all this detail. Not without a good reason. Of course, she doesn't have a good reason, but God does. This is going well. I have good timing so far. Verse 18 and 20, of course, she reveals David inquires, well, is Joab involved? Yes, of course he's involved. She's not going to sit there and lie about that point. She's not that foolish. It doesn't do her any good. But of course, at the very end, she says, my Lord, for David, this is verse 20, is like wisdom like the angel of God? knowing everything in the land. Is she buttering him up? Yes, she is. To avoid, obviously, any punishment upon her or Joab, because Joab obviously didn't do this thinking he was going to get in the raw end of the deal. I'm sure he would desire her to butter him up a little bit. And, of course, it finishes off that David obviously grants permission to receive Absalom. Absalom does not get to see David's face for 2 more years. I mean, it does not come before the king. That's done for a reason in the Bible. This is a messianic prophecy for a reason. It's not just written here for our fun of it. So he has to go around his own house, has to wait 2 more years before he's allowed to see David's face and receive the full blessing of from the king, which is important because that shows up for chapter 15 as Absalom starts to take the kingship. Are there any questions regarding this cursory explanation? I say cursory because I just talked to you about the text, what the text actually says. I haven't told you what's inside the text that you wouldn't necessarily catch unless you were reading it a number of times over and over and over again and see, oh, hey, I caught something. Okay. That'll warm up in a second here. Last week, or 2 weeks ago, I apologize. 2 weeks ago, I bought this chart out. I made copies for people at the time regarding the similarity between David and Adam and Amnon. And, of course, I made this nice little chart, but you know, I don't know how nice it was, but it was up here. It's still warming up. You'll see it in a minute. This is the same chart you already saw. I'm not telling you anything new on this particular chart. It just matched the duplicate similarities between all these three stories. Well, there's something off of this chart that left off for a very important reason. This chart is one which, granted, I added to it, but I was not the inventor of it. another book, by the way, in case you wish to read it or purchase it yourself, The Scroll of the Gospel of David by Tony Robinson, very important book. He analyzes 2 Samuel from 12 through 21 fabulously. He starts this and notes, hey, there are similar to these stories, please look at it. So I looked at it and saw them out. All these similarities, of course, with all three stories having a cunning individual in it, who, of course, contrives this right being wrong, becomes good idea, produces sin into all in three individual stories, tries to conceal it from God somewhere or another, or concealing from somebody. And, of course, goes this way. It matches very, very well. You can scroll down a little bit there, Richard. And you'll see, of course, it continues on from death being on all three stories, from Cain and Abel to Uriah and David and Absalom and Amnon. You have that particular serpent demonstrates to Eve that he was right and God was wrong. He demonstrates to David that, no, your individuals who are telling you that all your sins are dead are wrong, and I'm the one who's right because I know the truth. And, of course, David, of course, tells Joab that no sin will be upon you for the murder of Uriah. It's perfectly okay. Basically convincing them that what is right is wrong, and what is wrong is right, which is what you'd expect from a serpent, from the devil. That's the objective. So you have all these similarities, which I just discussed them quite in great detail. But these similarities I wrote down. The Bible didn't write them down. The Bible doesn't sit there and say, oh, Genesis chapter 573, you'll see all this mapped out details. It's not written that way. What does the Bible do to do this, what I wrote down here in this little chart for you? It does it through repetition. It does it through thematic ties and chiastic structure. Now, we discussed what these are. I'm going to discuss them one more time, because some of you probably worked around when I discussed them a number of months ago. Thematic tie. A thematic tie is nothing more than when I'm reading a section of the Bible, let's say I read some verse anywhere, doesn't matter what the verse is. I say, you know what, that verse sounds really familiar to this verse way over here. You now have a thematic tie. Both verses are designed to, are written in such a fashion to catch your attention, to remember them or recall them. For example, when we had discussed, obviously, in this story, you have the Adam and Eve and all these various similarities. These are thematic ties. You have, hey, an angel prevented the re-entry for Adam and Eve. And, oh, look, death stopped David and Bathsheba from reunifying with their son, and oh look, a servant locked out Tamar from Amnon's door. There's similarities. Like, oh, those look similar to one another. I should read them again. That's its point. You have Cain killing, you have all these various, Cain being banished, David being banished from building God's temple, Absalom being banished from David. You have banishment showing up. You have Adam bringing death into mankind, David bringing death into his family, Amnon brought death into himself. You have people causing sin, bringing death. These are thematic ties. They're similar to one another. They're not mashed out perfect, but they're similar. This is how you learn more information about one story from another story. This is how we can probably state that Bathsheba most likely was deceived or wasn't completely as complicit as the Bible doesn't say. When you compare it to Amnon and Tamar and Adam and Eve. He was deceived. Tamar was deceived. Well, if they're all thematically tied, there's a good probability Bathsheba was deceived. It points out that David was very, very cunning, more cunning than anyone. Note the serpent was described as being more cunning than any other creature. Well, Jonadab was described as being more cunning than anyone else. Well, those cunning individuals contrived details of an elaborate lie in order to get to their own means. So there's a good chance that Bathsheba was deceived. Not the whole way through, but somewhere along the line, she was probably deceived. You gather information that way. Well, that's one technique the Bible uses, but it has another technique, which I discussed many times in the past, called a chiastic structure. Let's describe this that might make sense to others who are more visually inclined like me. I can look out in the parking lot. I can see similar things out there. There are contraptions made mostly of metal and plastic with round things on the bottom. They seem to move in many directions. There's many of them. That's a thematic tie. They're similar items. Now, if I go out in the parking lot and see seven, completely duplicate vehicles, every way, shape, and form. They're all set in a row. There's for three vehicles right here. The middle one, let's see, all of them are blue, but the middle one's yellow. And then there's three blue ones over here. That is not a thematic tie. That is a chiastic structure. It is built in a pattern for you to watch, and it's drawing your attention to the yellow one. That's the difference. Yeah, they're thematically tied. They're all vehicles. But they're set up in a pattern. Well, the pattern is what God uses to catch our attention. This is just one method He uses. Thematic type, things that sound similar. The other method, which is sometimes more difficult to spot, is when you're reading along and say, wait a minute, didn't I just read this? I just read this. This is exactly what happened three verses earlier. Why are they saying it all over again? That's what catches your attention. You're inside of a pattern. I see a blue car. Look, right, it was a completely identical blue car. Didn't I just see this perfectly identical blue car right here? Yes, I did. There's a reason. Well, chapter 14 is no different. Will you please highlight the other, which is this one right here. This is 2 Samuel 14 in a chiastic structure. Chiasmus, or it's a Greek word, I forgot what it meant. It's basically, it's a pattern. No different than song lyrics are in a pattern. A poem is in a pattern. Song lyrics' objective is to draw your attention to the chorus, because it repeats the chorus over and over and over again. While a poem is designed to catch, usually, one or two phrases that are repeated over and over again. A chi. That's what it is. So, chiastic structures, or God, is no different when He writes His own texts. This structure is built up from 2 Samuel chapter 13, from verse 34, and it stops in 2 Samuel 14, verse 23. I made a couple copies for those of you who wish to see it physically in their hands, because I'm a very visual person. I'm not that great at, verbal description kind of loses me really, really, really fast. So, it's Carmel, too. There you go. Now, in this of course, is a Xerox sheet of paper, because I'm not a very good typer. I'm terrible at computer work, and it's easier to just, copy. So I only wanted this particular structure. Note the similarities. Chiastic structure is a repetition of items drawing your attention to one event. Or usually one, it can be two or three events, but this particular one is one event. Notice points out this Samuel 13, verse 37 to 14. Absalom flees, he runs to Geshur, and Joab perceives or understands that David has his heart set after Absalom. That David has maybe he's been mourning, I don't know. It's been 3 years of this, waiting. Note how very similar that happens to be, or very similar in some ways, to, at the bottom of your sheet of paper, it points out 2 Samuel 14, from 22, verse 23. This is David commanding Joab, this is, go back and bring back the lad Absalom. Now note, Absalom flees here to Geshur, and he's brought back here in Samuel, chapter 22, verse 3. So Joab realizes, that I found favor in your eyes. Note, he perceived David's heart before. And now he realizes it. Perception and realization are very similar to one another. Continuing on point B, you have Joab sent to Koach, brought a wise woman from there. And Joab, of course, put the words in her mouth. She fell on her face to the ground and prostrated herself. Note how similar that happens to read to 2 Samuel 14, verse 19 and 22. He, referring to Joab, put the words in her mouth. Note the similar phrase of your maidservant. My lord is wise like the wisdom of the angel. It was a wise woman. Joab fell upon his face, the ground, and prostrated himself. Note, she did the exact same thing in verse 4. Or 3 or 4 or 5. Verse 5 through 7. David says, what problem do you have? Well, in verse 19 through 20, David says, is Joab's hand with you? The woman, of course, relayed the story. And, of course, in verse 4, 5 and 7, she relays her story. She's relaying stories. He's perceiving that somebody's involved with this and wants to know what the story is. Continuing on point D, David commands the issue regarding the woman. Of course, 2 Samuel 14 to 17, the woman refers to David's command regarding her son. And David, of course, issues a command. Point E. Please let the king remember the Lord and do not permit avenger blood to destroy anyone or my son. Of course, in verse 16, it points out the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who will destroy me and my son together. Not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. In verse 11, of course, repeats again in verse 14. We will surely become like water spilled upon the ground and cannot be gathered up. Note, when you drop a hair on the ground, can you find it again? Dirt. But we're talking like, a nice clean floor. Dirt. Usually don't. My point for all these little chiastic structures is the dead center. There's a reason she repeated her story to draw your attention to 2 Samuel 14, verse 13. That's why it's written in this fashion. That's why the structure is written out this way. So what's so special about chapter 14, verse 13? It says, why have you schemed such a thing against the people of God? The king speaks this thing as one who is guilty, and that this king does not bring his banished one, referring to Absalom, home again. What would be God's objective to draw our attention to 14, verse 13? Well, when you read that, this is her moment. Right? This is the moment when she relays, hey, my whole story is about you, David. When you read that, what does it bring to your mind? What's the first thing that comes to mind when you read that one sentence that you read up to this point? Back to Nathan, doesn't it? That's what it brings it back. It brings it back, wait a minute, Nathan did the exact same thing, just sprung it on him. This is how the Bible tells you to go do something. It's telling you, in 14 verse 13, go read that section of Samuel 12, verse 7 through 10. That's what it's supposed to do. It's doing its job. You say, hey, I heard someone spring this on it. It was just a few chapters ago. He says, yeah, go back and read it again. Let's go back and read it. It's telling you something very important about what's happening in chapter 15. To speak of that fashion, it is. Now, granted, Joab took a very wise woman, and to be able to pull this off, to have confidence that she would have no repercussions for it either is very bold. You're right, a bold woman. So 2 Samuel chapter 12 is what it's pointing you to because that's what it reminds you of. That's known as using a chiastic structure to establish a thematic tie. It's complex, but it's not so complex you can't understand it. God isn't quite that manipulative. He actually teaches us stuff to help us learn, not just for the fun of it. So this is supposed to bring you back to the moment which Nathan says, David, you're that man. So let's go to verse 7 of 2 Samuel 12. Nathan said to David, "You are that man. Thus says the Lord, God of Israel, I anoint you king over Israel. I saved you from Saul's hand. I gave you the house of the Lord and the woman of your Lord into your bosom. I gave you over to the house of Israel and Judah. I gave over to you the house of Israel and Judah. And this were not enough, I would have increased you for this and much more again. Why have you scorned the word, doing evil in my eyes? You have struck Uriah the Hittite with the sword. His wife you have taken to your wife as your wife, while him you have killed by the sword of the children of Amnon. And now the sword will not cease from your house forever, because you have scorned me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be a wife unto you. So says the Lord. Behold, I shall raise evil against you from your household. I shall take your wives before your eyes and give them to your fellow man, who will lie with them in the sight of the sun. Though you have acted secretly, I will perform this deed in the presence of all of Israel before the sun." That was the objective of this, 2 Samuel 14, verse 13. To bring your attention to reread that. Why? If that's what comes to your mind, then go do it. If I read, oh, this is a very cunning individual, oh, I should go read out about everybody who is cunning. Because I've read that before. Remember, we discussed with Jonadab, it points out, oh, he's very cunning. Oh, wait a minute, David was called cunning. Oh, so was the serpent. Ooh, there might be something here. If it brings your attention to go do it, to go read it, then go read it. That's what the Bible's trying to tell you to do. It's an action item. Not just for you to contemplate, but just go do. So it just told us to reread that. Why? What was the objective? What's God trying to get us to observe or see? What about the judgment? Because obviously, Nathan has stressed the judgment. This is the penalties, this is what you will go through. Well, note, it's a warning in many ways. In verse 10 it says, "The sword shall not cease from your house forever because you have scorned me and taken a wife, Uriah the Hittite, to be a wife unto you." Did David understand, or has he seen that so far in chapter 14? Has the sword ceased from his house? No. He actually is losing his sons now. All right? Two sons are dead. One by the hand of God, one by the hand of another, of his own son, within his house. So David, so far, when the Tekoahite woman's talking to him, is realizing or receiving the punishment, the judgment of the sword should not leave your house. Is that what she's telling him? Was her whole story about a sword leaving his house or that death is happening to him? No, that was the base of her story, but that wasn't her objective of her discussion. Note what she's actually talking about in chapter 14. Is it talking about a brother killing brother? No, not exactly. It's talking about blood avengers killing her last son, taking vengeance for the brother killing a brother. And she's asking for pardon or forgiveness. That's the objective of her story. She's using the base of a brother killing a brother to receive a pardon or forgiveness. Now in this, you note, it says, another big thing about her story, is it points out that one brother rose up against the other brother to do this, right? That's part of her base of her story. That's her foundation she's built upon. And of course, in this, it points out in chapter 12, that in verse 10, this was the seat of your house. We already know that David is already experiencing the loss of children. He will continue to experience loss of more children, but so far we already know he's experiencing that now. What has he not experienced yet? Well, if our attention was to draw back to read this again, he's either going to experience one of three things. He's either going to re-experience the sword not ceasing from his house, or he's going to experience so far that God will raise up evil against your own household and I shall take your wives away from before your eyes and give them to another. One of those three items, note, evil gets within your own household, and the third one is take your wives and give them to another. One of those three items David is about to experience again. Which one is it? No. The one in the middle. God does it in order. He does things in order sometimes. It is, I shall raise evil against you from your own household. That's what he's going to experience next. It's a warning to him. God's telling Joab, create this silly story. Give this to the woman. Make it fashion however you wish, doesn't make any difference. I'm going to draw David's attention to see step one I've gone through. I will continue to, by the way. But step two is about to begin. It's a warning. I'm about to bring someone up within your own house. And who is that individual? Well, the entire story she's referring to talks about Absalom. So she, unwittingly, is telling David, the individual who's going to be brought up for your own household is Absalom. To experience part two of the three penalties you have to receive. That's what she's telling him. Does he see that? Of course not. That's silly. How would he see that? He'd have to sit there and read these texts and, wait a minute, what's going on? So was it really for his purpose that this is written down for us? It's for our purpose, not for his. So what purpose does it serve us? Any ideas? God's true to his word? Well, that's good. That's a good foundation to repeat it periodically. Well, all right. I know I've thrown a lot of complicated things at you for the last, half hour or so. Though this looks complicated at first, it's actually a very simple understanding of what's actually happening here. And it's nothing new the text doesn't already tell you. It's just drawing your attention to some things that are unique that are happening in chapter 14. So, as I mentioned last time I was up here, I had said, if I'm going to believe that Absalom is somehow a messianic figure, instead of just some guy defending his sister. What were the things I rattled off I wanted to see happen? Do you remember? Well, one of them was that I want to see him raised from the dead. If he's supposed to be the most complete messianic figure spelled out in the Tanakh, which he is, I want to see some details that tell us what the Messiah is going to live like. I want to see him come up from the dead. Remember that? You might remember that. If you don't, that's okay. I just told it to you. What else did I say? Two men. I want two men going down with him. Somehow. Now, however God wishes to do it, that's fine. I just want two guys going down with him. Now, they don't necessarily have to be friends necessarily of his. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. They may not have to like him, because one agreed with Messiah, one didn't. There's got to be some kind of a dichotomy going on there. We'll see. I don't mind. God can be liberal with his of how he interprets the words that I'm requesting. Because when I'm requesting that it happened a long time ago, it's kind of hard to go backwards and change time. There's a couple of things I brought off. I don't remember all of them, but those are two things I want to draw your attention to. 3 days, that's right. I wanted 3 days to happen. That's right. Messiah was killed on a tree, wasn't it? He even had a crown of thorns over his head. I want that too. I'm asking a lot, but you know what? God delivers. So, this was written down to draw our attention to 13, 14 verse 13, which then brings our attention to 12, verses basically 7 through 12. 11? Yeah, 7 through verse 12. Which tells us what exactly? Well, if you go back to verse 14. Sorry, chapter 14. Apologize. It tells you the same thing that the entire chapter 14 already tells you. In Numbers. not the book of Numbers, but in number format. How long is Messiah dead for? How long is Absalom banished for? 3 years. How long is Absalom not before the king? 2 years. How long is Messiah not king? How long is Messiah not king? 2,000 years. There's some similarities. Was Absalom banished for a sin of his own? Was Absalom banished because of a sin of his own? No. The Torah allows what is called a blood avenger. When you rape one of your own sibling, that sibling or her caretaker is allowed to exact vengeance upon you. So was he banished for his own sin? Was Messiah killed for his own sin? He was banished for his brother's sin. Was Messiah killed for his brother's sins? See some similarities here? So far, there's more. The Tekoahite woman, Tekoah, whatever her name is, I don't know what her real name is, it doesn't make a difference. She points out something to David. Why have you schemed something against the God's people? Why have you planned something so evil against us that we would take vengeance upon Absalom for doing what is right? Another way of wording it. So, in 2,000 years later, after Messiah is dead, do you think some angel or some individual is going to go before God? Why have you schemed against your people? Bring him back. Most likely. Because it points out God always says he is reminded about something. Oh, remember, he remembers the people of Egypt, in Egypt. He remembers his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, what, did he ever forget them? No. But an individual has to bring it to his attention. This woman brought a wise woman. This is telling you an overview of what the Messiah is going to be doing through Absalom. It's drawing your attention to spot them. It's designed to catch your attention that this individual is about to give David his number two punishment. Rise up from within your own household. And what exactly does Absalom do? We already know the story. He rises up and takes kingship. Is that not what the Messiah is supposed to do? He is. That's precisely what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to be dead for 3 days. He's supposed to wait a waiting period, which so far we've noticed from Esther is a series of patterns of two. 2,000 years sounds good. We know that he's supposed to die or be, in this case, Absalom, for not for a sin of his own. The Messiah died not for a sin of his own, but for a sin of another. He's throwing himself down, so to speak, on behalf of someone else, his sister. Yes, Ellie.
Are you saying that she's saying the people are suffering because of a judgment that you have not fulfilled?
This is what's brilliant about this woman. She's a lot smarter than I first gave her credit for. When this is a wise woman, she's really, really wise. But not for that reason, I don't think. Who is actually suffering? David is. With Messiah's death and banished, who actually suffered? God did. The dad. The dad suffered. He had turned his back on his own son, as you just pointed out, as David just had to do. It's giving you the story, the text. It's giving you and drawing your attention to similarities. It brought your attention that the next individual that she's pointing out, and Joab is the one who gave her the words, by the way, that she's pointing out is going to be brought up within your own family, your own household. Does David understand it? Of course not. He doesn't have to yet. He will soon, but not yet. In a sense, I think in chapter 20 or 21, he figures it out. She's telling him that ahead of time. Does she know what she's saying? Probably not. Does Joab know what he was saying when he gave it to her? Probably not this much detail. I don't think he did. She's telling him that someone within your own household, David, has got to punish you. He's going to raise up and take over your household. That individual happens to also be the messianic figure we're all been looking for. We're not the Messiah, don't get me confused. I said the Messiah, he's a messianic figure. Which means someone who's going to mimic actions of the Messiah. She, I don't think, understood that. But she did what she was told. I don't think Joab understood all that. But he did what he was inspired to do. I don't think David understood this yet. He figures it out shortly. So was her message sent for David's purpose? No. Was a story, a chapter written down for Joab? No. Was it written down for her? Was it written down for Absalom? No, because they didn't read any of this. They just lived it. It's written down for us to spot things, to spot similarities. My objective today is to bring your attention that God used something that looked confusing inside of a chapter to grab your attention to reread an earlier chapter. He also used not just the part that was confusing, but the part we understood. The 3 years, the 2 years, we understand that part. To also bring your attention to the individual being spoken about. He also used this chapter, as well as chapter 13. The events around, the circumstances around the individuals regarding who died for what, who was banished for what reason, whose fault was it, how they took care of their sibling, meaning Absalom took care of his sister, made her shame as she pointed dirt overhead, go away. She's now cleansed. Her husband is now dead. She's now officially, technically, would be a widowed woman, completely free to remarry, she chooses now, because now she's pure and clean. He accomplished all of that. The objective is to bring attention to this individual who, David, is the one who is missing, who God misses, who God had to turn his back on, who David had to turn his back on. It's designed to catch attention, to grab all these things, because in chapter 14 through 21, Absalom is going to map out the gospel. He's going to map it out. He's going to tell you what the gospel already tells you, but he's going to tell it to you almost 1,000 years earlier. Absalom's going to live the Messiah's life. He's going to die it too. But our job is to look at it and say, okay, focus my attention upon what the text is telling me to focus my attention upon. The individual known as Absalom. Because God, his own heart, David's own heart, is after him. Does that make sense? This, I know, is not easy to see at first. Takes a long time, actually. But building on it builds a foundation so strong, to my mind, my personally speaking, that I can confidently die with pride knowing what I believe. I can say, I can confidently watch my child be murdered knowing that this is true and not worry about that I make a mistake. Was I wrong? That's why it's written here. It's not written here just for the fun of it. God wrote it out here in chapter 12, 13, and 14 so far to grab our attention to a particular individual who's now we're going to try to trace his life and what he does as he takes kingship, as he goes through military pursuits, as well as David. We're not going to ignore him. Through the next few chapters, David also is a messianic figure, by the way. He never ended that process. He was still a messianic character. The deal is, as we point out with the king's heart, note, when Messiah was on the ground, did everybody ignore God? Of course not. God was still the key of your life. Messiah was just happening here to, you know, say where the door was. We still had to focus on God too. So while Messiah spoke, what did he speak about? God. So when Absalom, we're following him, what's his objective? To point us to David. Just like Messiah's objective is to point us to God, Absalom's objective would point us to David. David, Absalom's life is going to point us, which we're supposed to focus upon now, is going to point us to David. I know it sounds bizarre, but it's true. It's really easy to see once I go through a few chapters. Sorry, it's going to take a while. Did I lose anybody? It's going to take a while, so enjoy the ride. But the time's up. So chapter 15 will be a little bit different because I have to go through the gospel first and write out the sequences of events that you're going to observe in 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20. I'll try to pronounce. That's hard. That's a bad typer. It just takes forever. Anyway, I'll try to print out. We'll go with that. Yes, David.
Curious, are the two possibilities Joab and this Kohathite woman?
As far as which two are you referring to? Do you explain?
The two on either side of the Messiah.
In a manner of speaking, yes. In one aspect, they are. But there's another individual, actually, with a friend of his, that are, what do you say, destined to die, but don't. They're supposed to die, and figure speaking, they do, but then they don't. Those two we're talking about. Joab actually, in fact, does die later on. He gets killed. We all know that story. The Tokite woman, in this story, both Joab and the Tokite woman are bringing David's attention, which is essentially they are God's messengers standing next to God saying, hey, by the way, there's a story going on down here. Are you going to go and involve yourself with this? It's time. Messiah is ready. It's time. And God says, okay, thank you, messengers, for reminding me. I will go do this now. That's their service. So they are servants. Exactly what a messenger or angel is. A messenger is servant to God. So that's the role they're playing here. They're reminding and bringing David's attention to be objective, and that this is now the time. And he says, yes, it is a time. That's what a servant's supposed to do. In the two individuals that die but don't die, which we'll get to, they're doing another service for the Messiah. Yes, Ellie.
The people 2,000 years ago that knew, that saw the Messiah was the Messiah, if they looked and knew the writings and had access to the writings, the pictures were here. And that would have been why, when they saw him, they said, wait a minute. That story fits the stories we already know. And that's evidence and witnesses of the Messiahship of the Messiah.
You're absolutely right. That's one of the primary reasons why I personally believe that the disciples were far smarter than I thought they were a couple of years ago.
Became smarter.
Yeah, became smarter really quick. That's quite amazing. is that they were able to come up with an idea of a first and second Adam. And where did that come from? How did they figure that out? Is that written in Genesis 1, 2, and 3? No, it's not. But it is here. It is with those three columns I showed you. There was the Adam and Eve. There was the David and Bathsheba. There was Ammon and Tamar. It is there. But you got to read the text really, really well to see that. You have to know the text really well. And before I could look at that and figure that out, and granted, I didn't figure all that out, figured out part of it, but not all of it, that took a lot of work. Those guys spotted up a whole lot faster than that. Granted, there was more of them. Maybe that's why. The Spirit of God probably had a lot to do with it in their fashion. But so yet, when you know the text really, really well, you can explain what's going on without using the gospel. I mean, you could theoretically, like all of them did, convince someone the Messiah is the Messiah with never even opening anything past, never actually going from Matthew onward. Can any of us do that? Can you prove the Messiah is the Messiah with never even opening from New Testament on? I can't. I can see similarities and refer to similarities that the Messiah did. I can see patterns. That takes a lot more work to say, well, there are no similarities to write about. It's just what the text says. So when Tony Robinson wrote that book about the scroll of Gospel of David, he did precisely that. He went through the New Testament. Okay, I write out all these little details. Let's find out what story in the Old Testament matches it. And he found one, known as Absalom and David. So this is it. He explained it all out. Great book. If you have time to read it, it's fantastic. That's one of the things which I'm talking about, which I'm using through this process. Yes, I'm adding to it, but that's the point. The point is that it's the way which you look and observe something. These guys in Messiah's time, the disciples, were able to look through this and can see the Messiah in just the text alone, having known the man, having met him. They can see it. They talked about it and convinced others of the same process. If you have access, which apparently they did, known as the Spirit of God, to see this and figure it out, you can see a lot. You really can. It's not easy, and I'm taking a long time to figure it out. It takes you know, quite a bit of effort. But each one of us has the same ability. It takes our time to do it. Those guys did it. They wrote it down very, very, very well. And they make ties and parallels that I would never have seen before. Any of us can read the New Testament and say, wait a minute, you did what? You tied scriptures out of Isaiah and Jeremiah and threw them together and said, hey, look, this matches life exactly, and they were right. Got to know the text really well to do that. Because they don't have it written in front of them to, oh, let's go look that up again. Let's go look that up again. No, they have it mostly memorized. Can any of us say that? I know I can't say that. It takes a lot of effort. So yes, I respect what those men did. I respect what they can do and have done. That's quite amazing. God willing, I'll ever have that, you know, strength. Any other comments or questions? I will be adding to this, so if I lost you so far, don't worry about that. I will pick you up again, probably next chapter. It's not that hard. This was just a base ending. I use chapter 14 as a second witness, that I call it, that verified that David and Bathsheba, with Nathan's help, was a match to Amnon and Tamar. Which, it was easy to prove Amnon and Tamar with Adam and Eve, so it's just a second witness that verifies all three are, in fact, true, not just some figment of my imagination. Have a wonderful rest of Shabbat. God bless you.